Welcome to Writers on Writing on KUCI 88.9 FM in Irvine, California, broadcasting from the campus of the University of California, Irvine, and on the internet at KUCI.org. I'm Barbara DeMarco Barrett. Writers on Writing features authors, poets, literary agents, and editors discussing the art and business of writing. Today my guest is poet Diane DePrima, author of 34 books of poetry and prose, including This Kind of Bird Flies Backward, Dinners and Nightmares, Memoirs of a Beatnik, Pieces of a Song, and Loba. Her memoir, Recollections of My Life as a Woman, was recently released by Viking. She lives in San Francisco, where she works as a writer and a teacher. Welcome, Diane.
Hi, Barbara.
How are you?
Thank you. I'm well.
Diane, you have just been so prolific, and it seems that you started writing when you were a little girl.
Yeah.
How did growing up with Italian immigrant parents influence your finding your way to poetry?
Well, you know, I think what influenced it more was, I'm not sure, was my grandfather, who was my mother's father, who read me poetry when I was just 4 years old. He would read Dante to me, and in Italian. I understood Italian then. I lost it later during the World War. And I think his passion for literature was what came to me, because in our house, my mother and father didn't have that many books, although they were both college-educated, first-generation Americans, which is kind of unusual in itself. But aside from Shakespeare, which was they both really loved and read a lot to us, there were really almost no books. Very, very few books. But I was taken to the library early and showed how to get there and get back, and told that I could go there on my own. And then I began to live off of books from that point on.
Now, did they have any hopes of you becoming anything, becoming a writer? Or?
Oh, no, they had great hopes of me becoming a scientist.
Really?
Well, I was in the upper 2 percentile in the country in math and those universal tests they used to make you take.
Yeah.
Yeah, I was a math and physics person for them, and you know, Sputnik had just happened. And
that's interesting.
And everybody wanted people to go to school in science. They saw me as a scientist or a doctor or something like that. Yeah.
Interesting. You know, I was looking through. I have a few of your books, and I was looking through Pieces of a Song last night, and I'd love to read part of this foreword, if you don't mind.
No, I don't mind. That foreword was written quite a while ago by Creeley.
Yeah, it was by Robert Creeley, poet, and it has to be one of the most, one of the most lovely complimentary forewords I've ever read. And just, I just want to read a bit of this so that listeners can hear this. And I'm going to start down a bit. Diane DePrima is fact of that female principle whereof Williams speaks, not simply, certainly not passively, but clearly, specifically a woman as one might hope equally to be a man. I am not speaking of roles, nor even of that political situation of persons she has so decisively entered at times, nor of children and homes, though she has made both a deep and abiding pleasure in her own life and those related. It is some act of essential clarity I value, which in those initial occasions of her writing is already moving to declare itself, food, places, friends, nights, streets, dreams, the way. She is an adept and flexible provider of the real, which we eat daily or else we starve. She is kind but will not accept confusion. She is beautifully warm, but her nature balks at false responses. She is true. Growing up in the 50s, you had to figure it out for yourself, which she did and stayed open as a woman, uninterested in any possibility of static investment or solution. Her search for human center is among the most moving I have witnessed, and she took her friends with her, though often it would have been simpler indeed to have her to have gone alone. God bless her toughness and the deep gentleness of her hand.
Yeah.
Wow.
Yes, Robert is a wonderful man, very kind and generous.
Well, what just wonderful words, and somehow the conflict, there's a conflict and not at all a bad conflict, a conflict between parts of ourselves that he so captures here. And I just wonder, in terms of your life, you have this family, you have grandchildren, you're you're a poet. You are perhaps one of the most honest poets and writers I've known. How do you do this? I mean, is it just your nature? Has it been your nature from the start to just be honest in your life?
Yeah, I think that was just something that came with the package, the feeling of wanting straightforwardness from everyone, and being willing, wanting to give it also in exchange, you know. And I remember as a kid being very confused, or very, actually not so confused, as basically annoyed by the world that presented a face other than what was really meant, the grown-ups world doing that. I write about that a lot, I think, in my new prose memoir, Recollections of My Life as a Woman.
Yes.
This feeling of, you know, wanting everybody to just be straight about everything, tell the truth, you know. Mm-hmm. And for me, I think that was one of the things in the early poems that was a big motivation, was partly to memorialize things, keep them remembered, partly to just tell it the way I saw it.
Interesting.
And that continues to be one of the motives, certainly for the memoir.
Mm-hmm. In Recollections of My Life as a Woman, you're so open about your life. And the truths you reveal. Now, again, when you're putting this on the page, is it just a matter of putting it down, or is there anything you have to wrench out of yourself, or had to wrench out of yourself writing this book?
Well, there were a couple of things. One thing was I had to learn not to judge the younger woman that I had been, but to really be on her side at each stage of the memoir. Because otherwise, if I was writing from the outside, she wasn't going to reveal her secrets.
Mm-hmm.
So I had to really be there for the 30-year-old, or the 25-year-old who was making mistakes in love or in life or whatever. And then I really wanted to be careful not to make myself look good. So I wanted to put down all the variations, or all the stupid things I did, and also. I remember in the part of the book where I hear that my friend has jumped out the window, and the first thing I think is, in the book, I remember writing, that the first thing I thought, and this was true, was, oh, shit, he probably broke some bone, he probably is going to be actually committed suicide. But to put down that kind of basic annoyance, which is true, we feel like that at first when we hear of a tragedy.
Mm-hmm.
But I've never seen anybody write about that. But I was on her side, and she was sort of telling me, this is what I felt, this is what is happening. And then writing it wasn't a problem.
Hmm.
But it was a problem to get to the point where I didn't judge my younger self.
Yes.
And then there was one other thing, which was being willing to risk having family or others not like what I wrote. You know, I left out a lot of things that would hurt people, but nothing that would hurt people if I thought it was going to be helpful to many people to hear it.
Mm-hmm. And those things, did you go over anything with any of your family?
No. Oh, no.
Mm-hmm.
No.
Interesting.
They didn't see it till it was published.
And what was their reaction?
Well, some of them are upset about my portrayal of my parents. You know, my brothers are. My kids seem to be good with the book. They are, one of them thanked me for having written it.
Interesting.
But what I did was I replaced in my mind, while I was writing, all those figures with a little mental photograph album of the people I was really writing for,
mm-hmm.
like John Cocteau or John Keats, or friends that would understand what was happening, or old friends from those days and so on. So those were the things. It wasn't so hard to wrench to get to the truth as it was hard to not worry about how it was going to be seen.
Yes. If you've just tuned in, you're listening to Writers on Writing, and my guest is Diane DePrima, poet and author of Recollections of My Life as a Woman, published by Viking. There's a line in Recollections, something you said to your oldest daughter, and I think it goes something like, we all thought experience itself was good, any experience.
Any experience, yeah.
Do you still think that?
I think that for an artist, you have to have that. You have to experience as much as you can without permanently injuring the organism.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
It's a good way of putting it. Will you read to
us? Because you're in a vehicle.
Yes.
Yeah. Oh, the vehicle is material and can only go so far.
Mm-hmm.
Just like you have to be careful how you drive your car, too.
Yeah. Read to us.
Okay, what would you like me to read?
Well, I'm looking at pieces of a song, and there's just so many poems in here. How about, I'm just going to open it to one of the post-its I have here, and how about page 21, Frizella painting?
Oh, okay. This was a friend of mine that in a long ago time, in the late 50s. What are you thinking at night, these nights, night, when unsleeping the red, the hills where you walk, and who could tolerate that sky? 2. What blue is that, your eyes, your lumpy shirt, while you stand slumping in dawn light, same blue, and from your hands the cadmiums run, shouting.
Hmm. I read this last night several times, and I wonder if you'd talk about where it came from and how it took form.
Well, one of my favorite things to do in the 50s, and I had only a couple of people that I was that close to, was to sit and watch someone paint. And this is literally a poem of being at someone's house through the night and as the dawn light came in and watching her paint. You know, someone I felt very, very close to. And the emphasis on, in the second part on the blue of her costume, her eyes, the light in the sky, and yet from her hands is coming all this red and orange and bright yellow of the cadmium colors.
Mm-hmm.
And it's sort of like her passion, you know, against that blue morning.
Yes. It's a lovely poem, and I'm recalling another part in Recollections where you talk about having women lovers,
mm-hmm.
and I'm curious again. I mean, there's that honesty again where you just put it all out there. Well, at least you may be keeping some of it back, but as far as I can tell, it's all there on the page. And so when you're writing sections like that, and everybody, especially new writers, go through, what should I reveal? What should I not reveal?
Oh, I never think about that.
You don't think about it.
If I can get to that, I want it out there.
Mm-hmm.
And part of that, I think part of our job as artists is to extend the boundaries of what the discourse is, to extend the boundaries of what we can talk about among ourselves. And therefore, when those are extended, more stuff is in the conscious part of the mind, if we want to use that conscious-unconscious metaphor, then we're free to go even farther. Others are free to build on that.
Hmm.
So if I could find it out, it was in there. If there's stuff hidden that isn't in Recollections or in a particular poem, it's because it was still hidden from me at that point.
Hmm.
I don't write to, you know, in fact, there are some poets nowadays who say that a poem should be obscure. You should not say what you mean.
Yes.
And that obscurity is, you know, if you shouldn't be too obvious because somehow that isn't artful enough. I mean, I think what's artful is our lives themselves and our consciousness itself. So, no, if I can find it out, it's there.
So that obscurity that certain artists, certain poets talk about, why do you think that is? I mean, is it just another way to just remain hidden? Or is it that certain writers, artists, poets may think that being too open is, it becomes just memoir? It's not.
Well, I think they're afraid that it might become just a soap opera, but that's because they don't, if that's what they think, they haven't given themselves enough credit for the subtlety and brilliance of consciousness itself. But then also there's another thing there. It's just slipped my mind again, but there's a whole other area where there is obscurity and you can't help it.
Mm-hmm.
That's obscurity that happens because of the deepness and subtleness of the matter that's coming through you. That happens to me sometimes in some poems. You know, they're labeled hermetic or, you know, occult poems.
Yes.
In a way. A lot of Loba has that. And perhaps people want to seem wiser or more occult or more, they want the poems to seem more loaded than the matter really is.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know.
Mm-hmm.
You know, but there is obscurity that can't be avoided, but you can't fake that.
Yeah. Well, you're one of the very few poets I know of that has an agent. Most poets rarely, if ever, have agents. And,
yeah, well, I didn't get an agent because I was a poet.
Was
I got
it for
an
this
agent
book?
For the Recollections.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Yeah.
And is she at the same time, I think Sandy Dykstra?
Yes.
Is she at the same time now offering to help market poetry?
Well, she marketed Loba for me to Penguin, and yeah, I mean, she's working on whatever. But, you know, some of the work that I want to handle, she'll just tell me to handle it myself because, you know, it's not lucrative to be a poet.
Yes.
And it probably doesn't pay for her long-distance calls to me. So. We go back and forth on that. You know, if it's going to be poetry that's supposed to go to Penguin, then she'll handle it. But if I'm going to be working with a small house here in San Francisco or something, she'll probably just say, "Do it yourself."
Yeah.
And I do. You know, I've done it my whole life that way.
So is it different having an agent to market anything then?
Oh no. I mean, it took a little while for Sandra and I to speak the same language because she comes from a much more high-powered kind of world in terms of buying and selling and all that, but I think we're very much alike, really, and we really respect each other a lot, so it's a very easy dialogue. It's different having a New York publisher, you know, than having all the small presses that did my books up till 93 when I signed the contract for Recollections.
What are some of the differences?
Well, on the negative side, you don't have as much control over what something is going to look like. You do finally, have final say over everything that was or wasn't in either book. They didn't take out anything against my will and so on. And they went with my punctuations, which drove their poor copy editors crazy. But that's the negative side. On the positive side, you get a lot of visibility and the work goes places. And these two particular books, Loba, which is my long epic poem, The She-Wolf is what it means, and Recollections are books that I really wanted to see in a lot of hands because I think they're both going to help people a lot. And when I was doing the final revision for Recollections, what I had on my wall was two questions. Is it necessary to the integrity of the work? Will it be helpful to others? And those, if I was deciding to take something out or leave it in, those are the two questions.
That's interesting. That another good thing to remember. Tell me about Loba. It's a book-length poem, no?
Yeah, it was a book-length poem a long time ago, and now it's twice as long. It started in 71 with one poem and then one kind of a 16-page section, which I thought was the whole book. And I was married to Grant Fisher then. He was a poet, and he looked at it and said, you know, I think there's more going to happen to this. And he was right. And that was in 72, and I've been writing Loba now for 30 years.
Interesting.
And book one of Loba, which was about 180 pages, was out in 1978. But book two came out with Penguin. Book one and two together came out with Penguin in 98.
Mm-hmm.
So at the beginning, it was the only thing I was... All the poetry I was writing those early years of Loba went straight into Loba, but then later, other things, I was writing other poetry too, and it came more slowly and in various pieces. And I'm writing book three of it now. And it's the She-Wolf, and it's wolves and women and various figures from history and from mythology, but not anybody that don't feel like I have really experienced.
Yes.
It doesn't come from the head down, like, oh, I'll read about some character and decide to throw her in. Comes from what's been in my life.
If you have just tuned in, you're listening to Writers on Writing, and my guest is Diane DePrima, poet and author of Recollections of My Life as a Woman. Do you think as a poet it's necessary to study traditional poetic forms?
Well, not necessarily in the beginning, but some point along the line I think you really want to do that, because even if you never want to really write in them for your own regular writing that you consider your good work, by having to work in the forms, you get a much more suppleness and flexibility in how you're going to use the language. You learn to make the language bend. You learn to condense. You learn unless you're doing it really badly and you're being allowed to be poetical and make inversions like, dost thou, my friend, blah, 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 blah. But if you're not doing that, you're learning how to bend the language of now into those various rhythms and forms. And then, you know, whether you use those forms later or not, you have a lot more kinds of things available to you when you go back to your regular writing. So at some point, I know when I was in my 20s, I wrote a sonnet a day once for a month. And I threw all of them out except maybe one or two. But it was just the idea of trying that practice. Right now I'm teaching a workshop called Fun with Forms, actually. And we're just, that's what it is. We're having a ball.
Well, with free verse, then, if there isn't a structure, then what are you writing to? People always want to know, well, I don't get it. What do you write to if you don't have a structure?
There's an internal structure. First of all, there's a structure of your own consciousness. You know, that your mind itself is shapely, as Robert Duncan said, and Allen Ginsberg said, mind is shapely, art is shapely, and others before. There is a structure, there's an internal structure. You have to be willing to let go completely of the critic and be completely obedient to the poem as it takes you where it wants to go. And that's a very strange idea to a lot of people, but actually any of the arts, that's what we learned, most of what we learned and most of what we contributed in the 20th century, if you think about the painting or any of it. You have to learn to be obedient to your art form, where it wants to go, what it wants to do. And then there is the internal structure that you probably are not very conscious of, but has come out of everything you've written and everything you've read and studied, which is the various kinds of internal assonance of different vowels reflecting back and forth and so on, which will be all through the piece. In the same way that certain imagery, I've written this 300-page poem, and the stuff that comes up now reflects back some of it to what I wrote in 1975, and I'm not trying to do that.
Mm-hmm.
It's just the inherent structure of the piece. So there is an inherent structure to everything, and that's a good place to start.
Mm-hmm.
You know? And then once you get that, you allow the piece to take its own form.
And so where do you begin? Do you begin with an idea, an image?
I don't usually begin with an idea, although sometimes I did when I was writing revolutionary letters. Usually there's either an image, or you'll hear a rhythm, or I'll hear actual words and have to start writing them. Or sometimes I'll carry a painting or an image around with me until the words for it come, because I write off of those things too. So you begin any number of places, or you begin playfully, you know, making a random piece or a cut-up piece or making a collage, even a visual collage, until the juxtaposition of images or something catches you and the words start to come. But usually the words, rhythm, and all of that come welded together at one, and I do very little revising, some but not very much.
Mm-hmm. How do you know when a poem is finished?
It stops. The danger that people, that more than that, is like people revise their work to death.
Mm-hmm.
They revise it till it lies like a dead mackerel on the plate.
Oh, that's funny. It's so true. We're going to take...
because we want to impress.
Yeah.
We want our work to be impressive. You know, maybe that's what the obscurity is, too. You know, we want to be noted for our something, so we want to make the piece do what we want it to do. But that doesn't work.
Yeah. Well, before we take a break, I wanted to say that we also, I think, our writers also know that there's some revision entailed in all, and probably all writing,
yes.
But... you know, where to stop that process, and when to stop it is often writers are just, you know, in a quandary.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And do you think it also takes tuning in to a certain, certain wavelength of the work, just tuning into it in a different way and not being so literal?
I think that when you're revising, you want to do as little as possible, you know. Yeah, in order to bring about the... If you're letting a poem happen in the first place and it comes through you and it's on the page, probably the places you have to revise are the places where your attention broke in the first place, and if you didn't allow it to come clearly through you, or you tried to control it, or you tried to turn what it was saying to your own ends. With prose, something like a memoir, it's rather different. I did much more revising on that. Didn't come through me always. I just got up and wrote on it. Once I got started on any given section, like when you start writing just an image and you think that's all you have of a dream, and then the whole dream comes back. When I got started, I'd have the whole vision or the whole scene in my eyes pretty fast, but it wasn't a question of being obedient to it in the same way, and I did more revising there. But always, you know, do as little as possible, which is one of the maxims of ancient healing also.
Yes. Well, let's take a real short break, allow you to take a break, and our listeners can get up and stretch unless they're in a car right now, in which case do not do that. Just
really?
Stay tuned, and we'll be right back with more Diane DePrima. Don't go away. From the University of California, Irvine campus, I am here today with Diane DePrima, who is author of many books of poems and poetry, and her current memoir, Recollections of My Life as a Woman, The New York Years, and it's published by Viking. Diane, just before the break, you had said something about poetry being or requiring a different sort of process of revision, if any, as compared to that of the memoir.
Mm-hmm.
Would you talk about that, how you did this memoir? Was it one entire draft before you went back and started tweaking it?
What happened? I finished it long before I started tweaking it. I finished it, shipped it off to Viking, and for some reason got lost in the pipeline there in terms of my editor for a long time. So it was at least 6 months or more before it got back to me, and he had done all of his editorial tweaking in one blow too, and so I had this little thing on my desk that didn't look at all like what I wanted it to look like. It didn't sound like what I wanted it to sound like, because he was trying to turn it into regular prose and hadn't communicated with me about what was my intent by writing such weird prose. And so then I had to undo his stuff. And then it's still, after that was all, each piece of it, each suggestion that he made, I had to look at and say, does that work for me? And we're talking about a 750-page manuscript at this point.
Mm-hmm.
So I couldn't do that very long at a stretch. I'd do about an hour or two, and then I would lose my own sense of my own rhythm. So, because I'll give you an example. The very first sentence in the book, if I can find it here, is, my earliest sense of what it means to be a woman was learned from my grandmother, Antoinette Malazzi, and at her knee.
Mm-hmm.
The first thing he did was take out "and." So, was learned from my grandmother, Antoinette Malazzi, at her knee. That wasn't what I meant at all.
Uh-huh.
And so, by weighing each one of those for 750 pages, after a short while you lose what you meant at all, and you're going, you're sort of vacillating between your editor's sense and your sense. At that point, I'd have to stop. So it took a long time to deal with this perhaps hastily revised manuscript and put in the changes I wanted. And then we were still back. Really, we were at square one, because at that point, the cutting and so on that had to happen for the final manuscript still had to happen.
Mm-hmm.
But over the next period of time, that did happen. The book was longer in the pipeline of revisings and copy editings and so on than it was in the writing.
Interesting. Now, the 700-plus page manuscript, how much did that get whittled down to make it?
Well,
424 pages, I guess. Yeah.
Yeah, well, don't forget, manuscript pages don't come out one-to-one. So it was about a 650-page mm-hmm. manuscript. It was 420 pages. But I overwrote when I wrote. I wrote... the contract called for a 200,000-word book, which I had insisted on. I didn't want it to be short. They had suggested 125,000 words. So I wrote 225,000 words, so I had a 10% leeway for cutting in any case.
Mm-hmm.
And then I cut it more than that. So I think at the end it was about 170-something thousand words. But I purposely wrote more than I needed so that I could decide, do I want to leave this or do I want to leave that, and play with it some in the final process.
Yeah. Do you want to read from the book the first, page, over to page two, The Hiatus?
Page two of Recollections?
Yeah. Start with where you started with that first line and go to page two, right where it breaks.
Oh, okay.
That'd be great.
Sure. My earliest sense of what it means to be a woman was learned from my grandmother, Antoinette Malazzi, and at her knee. It was a house of dark and mellow light, almost as if there were fire and kerosene lamps. But to my recollection, there was electric light the same as everywhere else. It is just that the rooms were so very dark, light filtering as it did through paper shades and lace curtains, and falling then on heavy, dark furniture, mahogany and walnut, and onto floors and surfaces yellowed with many layers of wax, layers of lemon oil. The light fell as if on old oil paintings, those glazes, that veneer, sepia portraits, Dante, Emma Goldman. There was a subtle air of mystery. The light fell on my grandmother's hands as she sat rocking, saying her rosary. She smelled of lemons and olive oil, garlic and waxes and mysterious herbs. I loved to touch her skin. There was this mystery. She sat saying her beads, but the beads in her hand never completely left her apron pocket. My grandfather was an atheist, and if she heard his step on the stairs, she would slip the beads out of sight and take up some work. They had lived thus for 40 years, and the mystery was how much they loved each other. To my child's senses, already sharpened to conflict, there was no conflict in that house. He was an atheist, she a devout Catholic, and for all intents and purposes they were one. It would never do to argue with him about God, and so when he came into the room, she slipped the beads away. As for him, he never seemed to inquire, though those clear blue eyes saw everywhere. The I Ching has the phrase, he let many things pass without being duped. My grandmother's Catholicism was of the distinctive Mediterranean variety, tolerant and full of humor. When I was a little older, I would frequently hear her remark at some tale of transgression, sins of the flesh reported by a neighbor in hushed Neapolitan. Eh! An exclamation whose inflection communicated humor and seriousness, and a peculiar, almost French irony. Eh, my grandmother would say, the Virgin Mary is a woman. She'll explain it to God. This response to the vagaries of human existence, the weakness of the flesh, especially female flesh, gave me pause for thought. It indicated, on the one hand, that the Virgin Mary knew much better than God the ins and outs, so to speak, of human nature, what we were up to, and that she had a tolerance and intelligence and humor that was perhaps missing from the male Godhead.
Thank you, Diane. If you just tuned in, you were listening to Diane DePrima read from Recollections of My Life as a Woman, The New York Years. Diane, why did you choose this particular starting place for the book?
Well, I think it chose itself. As always. What I did do with the memoir, though, that was a little different, was I kept a notebook, and until I was about halfway into it, I had a notebook in which, if a scene suddenly arose before my eyes, I would write it. I'd write enough so I could have it when I wanted it, and that's how I chose what I was going to highlight and what I was not going to bother talking about. Because, you know, clearly, no matter how many words you write, you're not going to talk about it all anywhere. But as for where it started, I don't really remember. I think I just heard that, and that's where it began.
Interesting.
But I had written 120 manuscript pages before I got a contract or showed it to Sandra and got an agent or any of that. I'd been writing it for myself and sometimes publishing sections in underground, I guess is not the right word these days, newsletter that came out of Oakland called Mama Bear's News and Notes, which was a women's newspaper kind of thing with a lot of reviews in it. And my friend Alice, who ran it, asked me for a column, so I would give her six pages at a time of this. But I had written all of the young years and the war, World War II, before I actually got an agent. So when I was starting, I was just starting out of the wish to write this book.
Interesting. So after doing this book, and you did another memoir.
The other one is really a novel. It's really, you have to think of that other book as
interesting.
Fiction.
Okay. Yeah. Well, do you find that these forms, novel, memoir, and poetry, all come from different places, or is it all from the same place, just taking form differently?
Oh, I think they come from different places, yeah. I'm not saying that all prose comes from a different place. There's some prose I've written, like a book of mine called The Calculus of Variation, which is a prose book, that definitely comes from the poetry place. But this stuff, memoir or the novel, you have more, I have more control over. I decide that I'm going to work on it. And, I have these scenes that maybe have come to me at different times that I have some notes on in the notebook, and I take one of them and I start working on it. By the way, I didn't mess with the chronology of this. The way I wrote it is the way. Hmm. The final book, you know, I didn't take this part from part two and put it in part five or something. Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
But so in that way, there's some similarity to following a poem. You know, I was believing, as I do, that you know the mind has its own meaning and its own purpose beyond what we know.
Hmm.
But there's a much more conscious process to write prose. Poetry comes from a much deeper well.
Hmm. Now, do you think in terms of teaching, because you're a teacher and have been a poet for most of your life,
mm-hmm.
Should poetry be taught by form or content?
Neither.
How then? How do you teach poetry?
What I do is I teach people how to give up. And what I mean by that is, one, give up their ideas of what's poetic and what's not. Two, get out of their own way and stop trying to control the poem. Three, try out all kinds of sources, all kinds of imagery and so on that isn't theirs. In other words, we trade imagery in our classes. You know, we'll all tell a dream and you have to write other people's dream material or something like that. What you teach a person is to let it in by getting out of their own way and to trust what's going to come through that way. And it takes a lot to learn that. There are always a few people that aren't willing to learn that, but for most people, it's very liberating. So we use random techniques. We use other people's sources from the, you know, if someone in the class mentions that she writes from newspaper articles and someone else has never tried that, we go around, everybody makes a list of sources, and we all try other people's sources, stuff like that. And you can teach an awful lot, but what you're teaching is that the person has to give up their fixed ideas about what the art is and their identifying with it, wanting to kind of bludgeon you over the head with how great they are. That's what you can teach, and that's a lot. After that, the person can pretty much find their own way, though I do have later, you know, more advanced workshops where I teach. Oh, can I say my phone number in case anybody is interested?
Sure.
My number, if anybody wants to know about these workshops, is 415-841-0717. I do have somewhere I teach, like, Fun with Forms that I'm doing this year, or something I call Theory in Practice, where, well, next term we're going to be next fall we'll be reading Gertrude Stein's Lectures in America and Composition as Explanation. And in all those classes we write, too, we devise exercises that seem to us to come from the point of view of the theory that we're reading about. We'll be reading Muriel Rukeyser's work, A Life in Poetry, and we'll be reading Jack Spicer's various writings about poetry, and in each case, we'll try our hand at. In other words, what you teach a person is that not to be so precious, not their identity and their own message is not all that precious. They can try everything.
Mm-hmm.
That doesn't mean to say they won't go back to doing their own thing, but they'll go back with a bigger range. Do you see?
Yes, I do. Probably shaking people up and shaking them out of themselves in a way is probably the biggest challenge.
Well, that's the main thing you can teach. You can teach people to give up.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
It's not really different from teaching meditation.
You're listening to Writers on Writing on 88.9 FM in Orange County, California, and Diane DePrima is with us, and we're talking about poetry, and we've been talking about her book, Recollections of My Life as a Woman, recently published by Viking. You are, I believe, the only female writer who was prominent among the Beats, and you were with the Diggers. I remember reading about the Diggers back in, oh my goodness, 1970, the community in San Francisco who fed people, and you've done so much in that regard. How has all of that affected you in terms of, did it take you on a entirely different path than you would have been on,
I don't see how any of that could take you on a different path. I mean, the Beats were the Beats, and they arrived after I'd been on my own writing in New York for a while already. I dropped out of school in 1953. And, you know, when they came on the scene, it was just more poets writing in the vernacular, which I was already doing. So that was great. And, I became friends with them. But there's no way that any of that would take you away from your work. Mm-hmm. And as for the Diggers, no, I think at a certain point when the time is ripe for it, when you can do it, if you have deeply held political convictions and so on, it's quite energizing and quite a relief to be able to be active with them instead of just holding them in secret like we had to in the 50s.
Mm-hmm.
So the Diggers and all that stuff, all the activism of the 60s was very, very much a relief and very energizing, and it was like having a second time around at your youth, if you were me, you know.
Mm-hmm. You mentioned dropping out of school in 53. And I wonder what you think now of all of the emphasis on MFA programs.
I think that they're silly, for the most part, because what they're doing is they're, instead of helping people lose their, you can't generalize, I'm sure there's great teachers here and there, but instead of helping people lose their ideas about poetics and allowing them to be led by their inner voices until they finally find out what they're up to, and find out who they like by reading 1 million people, they tend to solidify the students' ideas that they already have by doing all this critiquing, which students that don't know anything about craft are encouraged to critique other students that don't know anything about craft. So you have the blind leading the blind, and you wound up with poems that are like pablum, for the most part, but all the strong parts taken out because somebody didn't like them. And people are very attached to this mode of working, this critiquing business. I think MFAs could do other things, but that seems to be mainly what they're doing in the places where I've seen them.
Mm-hmm. Will you read to us again?
Sure.
I'm looking
at Pieces of a Song.
Pieces of a Song. There's Poem of Refusal on 132. There's These Days on 131. There's Any Day Now on 130. There's a million poems in here I'd like to hear.
Okay, shall I read Poem of Refusal?
Sure.
All right. This poem was written after I saw two or three of those earlier mid-70s, 1970s, NET movies in black and white of different writers at their writing.
Mm-hmm.
And in some of them, the women were like this. And in some of them, one case, it was the woman that was the one that was being photographed. But anyway, it all comes out in the poem. Poem of Refusals. No strong men in shirt sleeves striding through my kitchen, warm and obtuse. Not me curled like kitten around a sleeping child and smiling seductively. No short skirts, no long breaths. I will not glance sideways after reading a poem to see if you understood it. No cozy patios, front yards. My cats will never be fat. No one will put me on a T-shirt. I may never learn to put on my own makeup. Don't want to sit quiescent in the car while someone else drives. No circles to go around in, no checkerboard linoleum, no dishwasher, washing machine unlikely, no flowers, good legs, plaintive poems about marriage. Wind is what men are, and my poems, the sea. Children like grass on the hills. They hang in there. or like a forest. They don't come and go. No rainbows. Only pelicans flopping, clumsy, hoping for that one big fish. You can bet I won't be wistful, let it go by, wondering later what it could have been like. My memories run together, and I'm none too sure now who did what to whom, what we did wrong. But I burned the script where I meet your eyes and smile.
That's nice. I like that one.
Thank you.
What is good training for a poet?
Well, one thing you have to do is you have to read everything. You really want to read everything that's been done in English for starts. You know, go back to as far as you can, and find so you're not cast. You don't. And people tend to read everything and think that means read the 20th century.
Mm-hmm.
But you know, go back all the way and learn what people have done, how they've use your ears and find out how they've set up these regular meters and break them immediately, like pre-Shakespeare, Thomas Wyatt kind of stuff. And after reading everything in English, hopefully you'll get enough other languages so you can at least read, you know, bilingual editions of poets. You want to find out what people have done so you don't reinvent the wheel every time you make a poem.
Mm-hmm.
And what they've done with syntax, what they've done with content, where they've taken us to, where the poem is now. It's a craft, like jazz is, you know, and you want to already know that bebop's already been invented, and you don't have to invent it. So in the same way, you want all that. And then you want really to go very deeply into whatever your real interests are outside of poetry, so that you have a really deep technical almost kind of knowledge of other things that you can use in the poems, the way, say, Gary Snyder has about ecology or Michael McClure about biology, or I use alchemy that way. But there's many, many areas, and any area can be what it is, and there can be, and there should be more than one, really. Things that you know well and love deeply, that you've studied well. You should travel, and you should live hard, and do what you can to experience as much as you can without breaking your body.
Yes.
Or your mind.
Hmm. And
I'm sure there's a lot I'm leaving out. You should garden. You should probably try something like cooking or making ceramics. They're similar in their use of the hands and the mind, and so on and so on. I mean, I think you need to be as universal a person as you can to be a good poet.
Hmm. And do all of these things you just said fit as well if prose is what you're after?
I don't know. I'm not really a prose writer. I'm writing some prose, but my basic craft and what I'm coming from is what I know about the poem.
Mm-hmm. We have 2 minutes left, and I wanted to ask you about something you said in regards to writing recollections, and that is not making yourself look good. Can you embellish on that?
Well, yeah. The tendency is, you know, you don't have to tell, or the tendency is to not want to look like the dope you were, or not to want to have been. Well, I mean, a million different ways. Not to have been a sucker, not to tell that part because it's embarrassing, and so on. But you really want to write something that's full and true, and also that the reader's going to be drawn into. You have to be yourself. I mean, you have to show those parts of yourself that you don't approve of, as well as the parts you do. You know, that's the biggest temptation for the writer is to manipulate words, whether it's in the memoir or in the poem, so that they look good, or they convince the reader of some point or something, and to just let it be what it is, not so easy, you know.
Mm.
In recollections, there's clearly some things I did that were really dopey, and you know, let's just let them be in there and not try to apologize for them. Then you don't have to do that. I mean, you're on your own side.
Yeah. So when does part two come?
Well, I'm starting to get little. I have bought another one of those notebooks, one of those soft rice paper things from Japantown here.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm starting to jot down a scene here or there that might want to go into it. I'm probably not going to work on it right away. I'm in the process of negotiating a contract with Penguin to do a book about writing the poem called Opening to the Poem. It's going to have a lot of my exercises from my Foundations of Poetics workshop, the one we were talking about, where people use random techniques and all that. So that'll probably keep me busy part of a year, and then probably by that time I'll have enough things jotted down to start the next one.
Yeah.
And I don't really think it's going to take as long as the first one because it just because certain things have just been ironed out, like knowing that you have to get to the point where you're on your side before you write part of it and so on.
Mm-hmm.
And having discarded the worries, most of them, about what other people are going to think about it.
Do you do first drafts, even of prose, in longhand?
No, not prose. In prose, I always used to write on the electric typewriters,
mm-hmm.
and now I write on the computer. And I keep all drafts, poem or poetry, until the final thing is definitely the final thing. You know?
Mm.
I'm about to go through the computer and throw out everything except the first draft and the final one on recollection.
Mm.
But I'll always keep that first one, because some of what I took out, I just took out because certain people were living.
Yeah.
And that could go in later.
Tell our listeners again how to reach you if they're interested in a poetry workshop or any of the workshops you teach in other areas.
Yeah. My number here in the San Francisco area is 415-841-0717. And you can leave me a message with your address. There's a summer weekend workshop I do every year up in Petaluma, which people travel from Southern California for sometimes. You just have to spend one or two nights in a hotel. It's all day Saturday and all day Sunday. So it's really, you only have to come up Saturday morning if you don't want to spend too much extra. And it's really fun. This year it's going to be on writing from dreams, our own and each other's and so on, and doing a lot of visualization in relation to that. And then my longer workshops are nine-month affairs. But I can send all that information to anyone who is interested.
Excellent. Diane, thank you so very much for coming on.
Thank you for having me. It was really fun.
Great.
Okay.
Thanks, Diane.
Bye-bye.
Bye. That was Diane DePrima. Next week, we'll have three writers of short story collections with us, sort of a panel on the air, if you will. Getting back to Diane, if you didn't get her phone number, just email me and I'll be glad to get you in touch with her. If you'd like to be on the mailing list for the show, email me at writersonwriting@earthlink.net or visit my website, writersonwriting.com. I'd like to leave you with a quote by Adrian Rich, who said, "I wanted to choose words that even you would have to be changed by." This is 88.9 FM, KUCI, in Irvine, California. I'm Barbara DeMarco Barrett. Thank you for listening.